history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and they have some stories to tell. Sometimes all it takes is for somebody to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. And that's exactly what we try to do here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. Often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I've had quite a few people tell me over the years, you got to catch up with Turk Eliadis. He enjoyed a Hall of Fame career as a football coach at North High School in Bakersfield, California. But first, he had to survive some close calls in World War II as a fighter pilot and eventually a prisoner of war. His given name is Jordan, and we're going to hear where the nickname came from. But first, Turk, tell me about your hometown, where you grew up, McGill, Nevada. How big a place is that?
We probably had maybe 10,000 people. We had three towns. The high school was in Ely. That was the hub. The copper ore was mined in Ruth. It was shipped to McGill, and there it was refined into copper bars. If you look on a map where Ely is, we're 300 miles away from Las Vegas. We're 300 miles away from Reno. In other words, we're well east of town, east of the state. Growing up there, there weren't many things to do, but I knew one thing. Sports was very important with us. All three towns, from McGill and Ruth, we all were centered at Ely, and we were very proud of our program there. I have a nickname of Turk. I better explain that, because there's a lot of people think my name is Turk Eliadis. If anyone came to my house and asked for Turk, my mother would be infuriated. But the thing that is crazy about it, my mother and dad were born in Turkey. A part of Turkey where basically all the people living there were Greek people. And then eventually they came to Greece itself and so on. And when they finally eventually came to this country, you know, by boat and so on, met relatives there at like I say, in New Jersey. They had one brother out here that worked for Kennecott Copper. That's why my dad came to McGill. And then, of course, he worked there his whole life.
And so you mentioned the nickname. Now, this is from your childhood. They started calling you Turk at a pretty young age?
We were having a little deal in the backyard. Oh, just, horsing around with a bunch of kids, you know. And most of the kids were Greek kids. They could speak the language. I could speak the language. That's not a problem. And at one time, I feel kind of embarrassed. I used to be able to write and read and everything. But while we were playing, my parents were talking Turkish. And one of the kids says, "What are they talking?" Because they knew Greek. "They're talking Turkish." Well, that took care of that. Everyone in that town of McGill, everyone had a nickname. I have a sheet back there where all these guys that I knew from high school, everyone had a nickname. It's the way it was. I look back on that now that I'm coming to the end of the road, basically. I am glad that I grew up in a small town.
So here you are, son of Greek immigrants, living in McGill, Nevada, the oldest of seven kids. Everybody's got a nickname, we know that, but what did you do as a kid? What were the things that you spent your time on?
The biggest thing? Sports, baseball, in summer, and fishing and hunting. We loved to go fishing. We loved to hunt. And those were main things when I grew up. There was a lot of competition among the towns. When I was in grade school, we played football. We didn't play on a grass field. We played on a dirt field. It wasn't until I went to high school that I started playing on a grass field and so on.
Did that make you tougher?
Well, I don't know whether it did or not.
Did you have an idea at that young age, hey, when I grow up, I want to do X, Y, Z?
I'm not sure. I know that the first year that I was at University of Nevada and I went back to grade school, I remember the principal asking me, "Well, what do you plan to do?" And I told him I want to teach and I want to coach. And of course, when I said coach, they couldn't understand that. You know, they had no idea. When you were playing at White Pine High School and we played football, the nearest town was 125 miles away. That was our first game. We played teams from Utah. We played teams from Salt Lake City. We had teams from Salt Lake City that came to Ely and played us on a home-and-home basis. And we played other Utah schools. There were just no schools in our immediate vicinity. The big game for us was Las Vegas. When we played Las Vegas, that was the biggest game of the year. We played Sparks, which is adjacent to Reno, and we played them. Then we played Fallon. Sparks was 300 miles away. Fallon was probably around 275 miles away. So we did a lot of traveling. We were playing a game in Salt Lake City. After the game, Coach Bledsoe, and he's the reason why I'm here, he was talking to this man. The guy came over, and he was the head coach at the University of Utah. And he asked me if I would be interested in playing for them. And I said, yeah, you know, anyone's never asked me to go play at a college and so on. But it wasn't maybe a week or two after that, the coach from the University of Nevada met me at the high school and wanted me to come and play at the University of Nevada. It wasn't hard for me to make a decision because I had so many friends that were in Reno. So I ended up playing. When we were playing, I don't remember what game it was. It was near the end of our schedule at university. We had the situation where the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. A number of guys in the fraternity house, they went in the service right away. Some of the older guys, I don't know why. But anyway, when we declared war on Germany, I knew I was going to have to go. We had our next to the last football game, and after the football game, there was a couple of other guys, and we went to Sacramento to enroll. I thought flying sounded pretty good, so that's where we signed up.
Had you ever flown before?
No, never flown before. It was all new. We took a test. I think there were four of us. Two of them didn't make it on the exam. The next day, we went and had a physical. I was the only guy that made it. When I went back, he said to me, well, you're in school. Don't worry about it. They're not going to call you for a long time or whatever. Anyway, it was in latter part of November when my dad got killed. And I was in school at the university, got home. Of course, I was very close with my high school coach. And though I was the quarterback on the high school football team, but I never carried the ball. Occasionally, I would receive a pass. You were a blocking back. That's what you were on. That single wing is what you were. But when I got to University of Nevada, I want to tell you, I remember the first day we were dressing and Marion Motley was there. Oh my gosh. I can't explain to you what a body. My God. He had to be 6 foot, but man, he was just like poured out that way. I want to tell you something. You'll think it's crazy. When our fullback, who was our blocking back, they had to do the blocking. You know who had to do the blocking? I had to block for those people. We played an army team here in town. I mean, there. And one of the guys I recognized, the name, because in the fraternity, it shows me tackling him. Of course, I didn't know who he was. When I got back here in Bakersfield, he was the head coach at Garces High School.
How about that?
Come to find out, the head coach of the junior college football team actually played in that game, but I didn't know that at the time. I remember we talked about it and so on. It's all they could talk about was Marion Motley and so on.
Well, and maybe some younger listeners don't know the name Marion Motley, but this is a Pro Football Hall of Famer, one of the greatest athletes of the 1940s. And here he is, your teammate at the University of Nevada. And you were blocking for him?
Yeah. When we played the Army team, I blocked for him that day. I remember the first time I went out to block that in, he must have hit me and knocked me. You know, most of those guys were all college guys that were in the service. They had some top-notch people.
Yeah, some of the air base teams and different service teams were among the greatest college football teams ever. Paul Brown had a team at Great Lakes in Chicago,
right?
Was legendary, and there were guys who'd been All-Americans who now are all on the same team playing for the service. So that's what you did while you continued at the University of Nevada until you got called to active duty. You kept playing. You told me about Pearl Harbor happening. And I know you've told this story a lot of times, but I imagine at the time, you're 18 years old, you're playing college football, you're chasing these dreams, and all of a sudden, the world changes in a day. Was that a shock to the system at the time?
Yeah, it was. I think the thing that irritates, and I can tell you a few stories about what happened there at McGill. It was important that you know this. They had two people from the Japanese government in Washington, D.C. at that time, and they were supposedly going to have a no-war agreement or something on that matter.
Right.
In the meantime, they were bombing Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese people realized why the Americans hated the Japanese so much, it was because it was unheard of. You're in there talking, we're going to get, peace and so on. In the meantime, you're bombing Pearl Harbor. I didn't understand a lot of this when I was inducted. They sent me to Tucson, Arizona. That's where we learned to fly. I came to Bakersfield, California, at Minner Field. That was basic training. I learned more here about flying than any of the other two. When you came to Minner Field, I remember. I mean, he took me up and put us in a spin. Now, can you imagine? Holy mackerel, he take it up. You have to go like this. You got to stall your airplane. You go up, it stalls, and now the airplane's in a spin. And then it's spinning, whether it's right or left, it doesn't make any difference. If you want to stop the spin, you hit the opposite rudder for a half a spin, and then you move your stick forward, which controls the ailerons, and you come out of the spin, and it wasn't really much of a problem. But the thing that made the most important impression to me, each instructor had five people working with here at Minner Field. But I will never forget, because it happened to me, when we were on the way home one day, I was with the instructor, and all of a sudden, he turns off the gas. I'm flying, and he turned off the gas. He says, forced landing. Well, you can imagine how I felt when he said forced landing. Anyway, I looked around, as all I could see was vineyards down there. I don't know where I'm going to land. He did something there for me that I did later on when I was flying out of England. We were on a mission one time to southern Germany, and for some reason, my plane wasn't operating properly, and there was a little bit of smoke starting to come out, and I knew that something haywire. The leader of the squadron, he says, is that plane on fire over there? And they were talking about my plane.
And you're hearing this over the radio?
Oh, yeah. And the guy says, you better abort and go back. Something happened maybe a week or so prior to all of this. We were on our way back from a mission, and we were in flights of four. We were in friendly territory. Once we got into France, we were normally in Allied territory. It wasn't a problem. All of a sudden, one of the guy's engines quit on him, and I could see him hitting the starter, trying to get that propeller to re-engage, and it didn't. We had four channels, and if you hit channel four, that's air, sea, rescue. And while you're talking to them, they get a bearing immediately. He started circling, and what we did, we circled him and circled him and circled him until he got down to, I don't remember what the altitude was, but he bailed out. We went right down on the water, and he waved at us and everything else. The day that I had that problem with the plane, I said to myself, there is no way I'm going to go across that channel with a bad engine. So what I did, I would fly along the coast, the cliffs of Dover. When you're flying along the channel there, it's a big white wall at that altitude. I was flying around 20,000 feet. I felt that if I had a problem, I could probably glide all the way to England. And then about that time, when I was working back and forth, deciding where to go, the darn thing quit on me. It happened to be that I had worked south of England, and I actually was in France when the plane quit on me. And I remember calling back, and I was Tudor 5-2. I called, and the guy says, bail out. I says, I'm not going to bail out. I'm going to take it down. I couldn't believe that guy telling me I'm going to bail out at 20,000 feet. That's crazy. Anyway, I was lucky. It happened to be that I could see the smoke on the ground, so I knew which way I'd have to come in and land. And what happened was, I just kept losing altitude, kept circling and circling and circling. I did something in an airplane that I only did one time in my life, and that was the day that I did it. Everything seemed level out there, but when I got down close, I came over a ravine, which was, oh, I don't know how deep it was, and I said, I have to get down right away, because I had picked this field up ahead, and I thought everything was level at the time. I cross-controlled. If you cross-control in an airplane, which means you have, let's say, left rudder, right aileron, or vice versa, your plane just drops like a rock, and it failed right away. Finally, I got out of it. You know, I picked up speed when I dropped, and I had the flaps down as far as they would go to slow me down, and I leveled off. And I just leveled off and kept my nose up slightly and just kept going, kept going, kept going. Bang. I hit the ground. You have straps on you. There was a little bit of a tug, but it wasn't. The field that I landed in was being prepared for spring planting.
It was all plowed already?
It was all plowed. Basically, yeah. It was all plowed. And I remember, here comes all the people. And no one could speak English. So I pulled out my map and I gave it to them, and they said, you're near Lillebonne, France, the southern part of France.
And before you put it down, did you know that it was going to be friendly territory, or were you not
sure?
Oh,
yeah. I knew I was in France because I was flying along the ocean. I was flying, trying to find the cliffs of Dover, and it was overcast. That's what bothered me. I kept flying back and forth, and I hoped that I could see the cliffs of Dover, and I couldn't. And just about the time that I was ready to turn around and go back, that's when the plane quit on me, and the guy told me to bail out. The moment that guy told me to bail out, and I said to him, I'm not going to bail out, I remembered specifically my instructor at Minter Field. He taught me more about flying than any of the other two. When I got to advance, we got an AT-6s. We did a lot of formation flying, but we didn't do any of the things that I did here at Minter Field. And I guess when you come right down to it, the experience that I learned with him, I think probably might have saved my life. I don't know.
And we're going to hear some other things that may have saved your life, but it's time right now for our first break. Turk mentioned Minter Field, and that airbase in Shafter, California is long gone, but a museum remains in one of the original buildings. Go take a look if you ever find yourself in Kern County. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Turk Eliadis, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.